This is Audible.
Sepultura, written by Nick Kine, read by Antonia Beamish. Sepulchre, noun. A hole made in the earth to bury a corpse. A place where something is buried. A grave. Verb. The act of placing in a sepulchre or tomb. Burial. Sepulturum. Noun. Lesser order of the Holy Inquisition, classified Ordo Minoris. Experts in the risen dead. Organization formed specifically to investigate and neutralize the so-called plagues of unbelief, more commonly referred to as the zombie plagues. Chapter 1. Two Bullets. The bloody streak down the wall told Morgravia the man did not have long to live. His mouth trembled like a priest murmuring a sermon, but nothing intelligible came out, just the passing of his last breaths. He had said his name was Oshanti and that he knew Morgravia, but his face was like a foreign country to her. She glanced over to the opening in the tunnel, where Oshanti had told her they had blasted through to reach her, and found a gaping dark iris staring back. Screeches echoed in that darkness, something sharp scraping against stone, and there was the scent of the abattoir, heady on the thick underground air. "We can't stay here," she said. Even with her fragmented memory, she knew that much. She had been saved, she supposed. It certainly felt that way. She had awoken, her arms and legs bound, and Oshanti frantically sawing at the bonds with his combat knife. Her strength had returned slowly, her senses slower still. They were halfway back down the tunnel before Morgravia realized she was out, but she couldn't remember where. She had tried to get answers, but only got Ashanti's name before the thing came out of the darkness at him. He fired his pistol, four heavy booms that echoed loudly off the smooth tunnel walls. The thing recoiled, injured fatally it seemed, though it all happened too fast, and it was too dark to tell anything about its nature. Morgravia found out a little later that it had cut him, opened him like a burst tire, and that was that. "We can't stay," she repeated more urgently when Oshanti did not respond. He nodded then, slow and ponderous, like an oil derrick tipping towards the ground. She'd begun to wonder if his head would rise again when it did, and he gripped her hand, the one already holding on to his. The lips moved, gummed up with the same gory matter that stained the wall, but he emitted no more than an agonized gurgle. A bundle of red loops sat in his lap, glistening in the stuttering lumen light overhead. He stared blankly, forlorn and disconsolate, at his partially eviscerated intestines. The screeching from the tunnel came louder now, undercut by a breathy wheezing like a punctured bellows. By the time she looked down again, Oshanti had pressed his hand and hers to Morgravia's chest. His eyes widened, conveying everything his voice could not. Another nod, one of resignation this time. He unclipped the clasp on his belt holster, tugging loose the heavy gauge stub pistol that had sat snug, surrounded by dark leather. It took some effort, and as he pushed the weapon into Morgravia's outstretched hand, his face had paled to the colour of alabaster. He held up two fingers on his right hand, the number of bullets left in the pistol. One for him, then one for me. It was only then, when faced with the inevitability of her own imminent mortality, that Morgravia realized how fast her heart was beating. It thundered with a god's voice. She took the pistol in a firm grip. The scraping and wheezing neared the tunnel mouth, and silhouettes began to form in the foggy black beyond. Aiming at Ashanti's bloody face, she saw relief as the eyelids began to close, and the breath he had been holding eked out of him like a slowly deflating balloon. Reacting, not thinking, Morgravia lifted her arm and fired off into the tunnel mouth. The pistol boomed, loud enough to subdue her thundering heart for a few seconds, and she hit something in the darkness. A lumbering thing, a heavy, hot, exhaling thing that brought with it the reek of copper and cold, dead meat. It fell back, or she thought it did. It was hard to tell, the light was so bad. Another screech tore into the shadows. Of pain? Of death? She hoped it was death. Ashanti had opened his eyes, expecting the pistol's retort to signal his end, and obviously wondering why when it did not. Morgravia only had one answer, and it was a poor one that she hated herself for giving. "I'm sorry," she said, absorbing every scrap of fear and anger in Ashanti's jaundiced yellow eyes, and ran. The scraping followed, more numerous, more frantic than it had been before, pausing only long enough to make Ashanti scream. Morgravia tried not to imagine the wet meat tearing that would come after as she half ran, half stumbled down the sump pipe. The tunnel connected to it, the subterranean sewer works that served the factoria and hablocks of the greater hive. A foul-smelling swill of shit and industrial waste splashed underfoot as she ran. It made her sick to her stomach, but she couldn't stop. They were coming, whatever they were. Heavy, hulking shadows surging up in her wake, that scraping refrain like a never-ending scream. Morgravia clung to the pistol, one shot left. She knew she wouldn't use it on herself. Either self-preservation or just rank cowardice wouldn't allow her to do that. She grasped it, a near useless lump of metal, holding onto the grip like a thirsty man holds a cup of water in an endless desert. And then she felt something give beneath her, a low cracking of rusted sump pipes and shearing metal. It was like stepping onto a stairwell in the dark that she didn't realise was there. As a brief but stomach-lurching sense of vertigo seized her, and she fell, screaming into darkness, until she hit grimy water. She panicked as the cold struck her, punching the breath from her lungs, sending needles through her nerve endings. "Not like this, not like this, not like this." But fate doesn't care much for desire. And Morgravia sank beneath the water, her body carried along by its violent current. It filled her mouth, her nose, made her blind and deaf as the searing heat of drowning crushed her with vice-like finality. And then, peace. Morgravia awoke with the taste of sump filth in her mouth. She knew it was an illusion. A weird sense memory, and her mind's oh-so-humorous way of remembering her past trauma. Loomis. Candles flared, their sodium generators buzzing noisily as they activated. The light revealed a small hab unit. It was bare ferrum, a chair in one corner, where Morgravia had draped her clothes and other meagre belongings, a deep metal wash sink in the other. A rough mattress served as her bed. Scowling at the fever sweat dampening her thin sheets and blankets, and shivering at the chill prickling her flesh like a haunting spirit, Morgravia hauled her weary body into a sitting position. Pain struck her with a legion of daggers. It was all she could do to stop herself from crying out. A single hexagonal skylight let in the flame-lit pre-dawn of the low hive. She stepped through its grainy shaft and over to the chair, where she rummaged around in her long coat. Finding a handful of stims, she bit down, wincing at the chalky non-taste, and went to stand before the room's full-length mirror. She looked upon her naked form, enacting a daily ritual. She was lean-limbed, muscled, but not grotesquely so. Pale, milky skin reflected the light. She was tall, around 6 foot. One ice-blue eye looked back at her, alive with more vitality than she felt. The other one, yellowed and bloodshot, was a truer reflection of her physical and mental state. Silver-grey hair, shaved at the temples, a short mohawk forming a raised channel running between them, framed a stern but not unkind face. Yet it was strange to her, a rogue identity staring back from the dirty glass. Only the scars made sense, and these she found mostly unchanged. They threaded her body like zippers, a cross-hatching of permanently discoloured flesh that forced a mildly disgusted frown onto her face. One pull, and she would unravel. All the warm, wet red inside would come tumbling out. Her flesh left a flaccid and empty vessel in its wake. Undone, she thought, tracing the frenzied lines of scarification with her fingers. It had been 31 days since the tunnel. Emperor's mercy, she whispered, and looked away, reaching for her tunic. Morgravia froze, her hand poised in midair, her body half turned. A sinister figure stood before her, limned by the skylight, and for a moment she wondered if it were an actual spectre and not just the fever sweat washing her skin that had caused the chill in her bones. It smelled of blood and oil and detached itself from the shadows with silky yet syncopated movements. A blade flashed, its edge silvering in the light. A face with a rictus grin, two hollow sockets gaping around faintly glowing red eyes, regarded her. Morgravia set down the pistol she had snatched from her gun belt, letting out a shuddering breath. The rictus face crumpled into a frown. You should put on some clothes, mother. You will catch your death. Morgravia scowled and grabbed her tunic. What do you want, hell? Christo had worked in the labour pits of Meager all his life. He was a bullet maker, and a good one. His shells and munitions had a 93% approval rate. Not many factorum labourers hit 93%. He took pride in his work, though it was backbreaking and largely thankless. His proficiency at his job did yield some benefits. Slightly better food, his pick of the munition lines. Not much, but it left his belly fuller and his skin cooler, positioned as he was as far away as possible from the smelting furnaces under the labour floor. It also attracted jealousy from some of his fellow workers. Toil in the pits was hard, relentless. It bred strong bodies, but resentful minds. That resentment was usually reserved for the overseers, who tempered the slightest suggestion of unrest with the lash or the pain maul, all the while sermonising on the purity of hard labour, the cleansing baptism of honest sweat given in the Emperor's name. When offered the opportunity to direct his impotent fury somewhere other than the untouchable enforcers of the Emperor's will and war machine, a man would take it. He would exercise that crushing sense of futility where it could be vented, where his suffering could be displaced onto another. Christo had heard the muttered threats and caught the bitter glances directed his way. He had never believed they would be acted upon. Not at first. The labour pit was a congested battery farm of human bodies lurching in metronomic tandem. So numerous were the workers that maintaining vigilance over the entire labour cadre at all times was impossible, and yet no one man would raise hands against another for fear of reprisal. Not in the labour pits, at least. There were antechambers that bled off from the main pit, however, and these were less frequented. Several refectoria allowed for the taking of meals, and an ablutions block served doubly as a decontamination chamber. They had come for him here, jagged metal shivs glinting in the grimy washroom light. Three men, none of whom Christo knew by name, though he recognised their faces well enough. The encounter had been short, brutal. He had killed them all, naked and caked in the rough, powdery scrub that served as a cleansing agent. Christo was not a small man. He had bulk and muscle that his attackers' strength in numbers failed to balance. It had happened quickly and almost silently. Christo had been left with half a dozen lacerations, bleeding red into the grainy grey runoff gurgling down the drainage vent. Of his three attackers, one suffered a broken neck, another took a shiv through his jaw and up into his skull, and the third had his eyes gouged out so deeply it was possible to glimpse the inside of the back of his head through the grossly distended sockets. Christo had dressed quickly, sluiced the ablution cubicle down, and dragged the dead men one by one to the furnace. Dull-eyed and indifferent servitors were the only witnesses to the deed. He had never spoken of what had happened, for to do so would invite the strictest censure. The men would not be missed. Their loss, if it was noticed at all, attributed to the high attrition rate within the labour pit. Punishment for murder would result in lobotomization, and Christo had no desire to join the pallid ranks of the half-alive automata that saw him immolate three corpses. To kill in the Emperor's name was one thing. To kill those indentured to his holy service was very much another. Christo considered this as he waited beneath the overhang, a knife strapped to his belt and a handful of spent bullet casings clenched in his fist, and knew he would have to kill again. He stood in the shadow of Wrecker's Curve, the old bridge between the Ferro Hives and the commercial district called Fallowhope had seen better days. It arched like a broken man's spine, dilapidated and only fit for demolition. Two-thirds of the way across, it ran to a sheared cliff edge that plunged into a deep gully where the detritus of its collapse still lay in heavy ferrocrete chunks and twists of metal rebar. Moving out from under the lee of the bridge, Christo descended into the gully towards a ring of distant torchlight. As he drew closer, he made out a dozen drum fires arranged in a loose circle, a crowd of jeering, catcalling figures in rough leather and scavenged factorum overalls leaning in around the cordon of flamelight. The crowd were animated to the point of fervour, amped up on narco and cheap still alcohol. Most were armed. Christo saw cudgels, freight rail spikes, blades. No guns, though. Gaps appeared as the crowd shifted to bay or shove or hustle. Each offered a fleeting glimpse of what lay beyond them, of what was in the circle. Two urban gladiators, hands wrapped in bandages for grip, armoured in war paint and leather. One carried a length of broken chain, her hair a fiery red and sticking up in spikes. The other hunched behind a drum lid, using it as an improvised shield. One side of her head shaved, the other left to grow long so a violet swash of hair covered half her face. Both were cut, the one with the chain hungrier for the kill. As she raised her arm to lash out at her opponent, Christo got a decent look at her. That's when he started to run. Chapter 2. Chain Blades. "And stop calling me that," said Mulgravia, pulling on her breeches before buttoning up her tunic. I'm not your mother. Hel sketched a jerky bow, the effect more than a little disconcerting, and Morgravia gave a slight shake of the head. You're as messed up as I am, she muttered.
You look tired, mother, my lord.
Tough to argue with that, thought Morgravia. Crimson tunic, dark brown breeches, at least they concealed some of the outer scars. I feel like someone set off a chain blade inside my body. I'm beyond tired. I'm livid with pain.
I have been abroad in the Hive City, Hel announced, cheerfully changing the subject. Her short and slight appearance and oddly naive demeanour belied her lethality.
That's what made her so dangerous, Morgravia reminded herself. Hel whipped one of her swords over her shoulder, sheathing it in a thin scabbard strapped to her back. She did it swiftly, fluidly, and with a trained killer's grace. This is what she was, of course, a killer. A rough blade honed to a lethal edge by one of the Emperor's death cults. The Sanguinous, or some such, Morgravia could not remember. But these days, that was nothing new. Just tell me you didn't murder anyone, she said, tugging on knee-length boots that went over her breeches, and then picking up a dark green flakweave bodice, a bullet stopper at anything but point-blank. Pretty good against ranged weapons, too. Fuck all use against a knife, though. Here, she said, and gestured to her disturbing companion. Don't just stand there looking grim and forbidding. Make yourself useful. The bodice pushed in her ribs as Hel tied it off and affixed the mag clasps around the back.
Thrown, Morgravia gasped. I do not enjoy wearing this thing.
She gave Hel, who was bound in a black-red body glove, a side glance. A raft of exterior metal studs caught the light, and the rags of death oaths were tightly cinched around Hel's arms and legs. A synthetic skull mask was near imprinted on her face.
How do you even stand wearing that all the time?
Hel canted her head, like a predator assessing a sudden peculiarity in its prey.
Pain and forbearance brings us closer to his glory, she said.
I thought you'd say that, Morgravia replied, strapping on her weapons belt before engaging the fingerprint access of a small lock casket secreted in the inner pocket of her long coat. The lid clicked loose with a hiss of depressurization. Did you see any sign of them? She asked.
I did not.
But you found trouble.
There is always trouble in Blackgeist.
Morgravia smirked and gave a mirthless chuckle. Too true, though we agreed you'd do it quietly.
Confrontation was inevitable.
So you did murder someone?
Several someones.
Morgravia swore under her breath.
It was necessary to retrieve the information you desired.
Hope coloured Morgravia's voice. You found him? Hel nodded, Morgravia reciprocating with a nod of her own. Good, she said.
Hallow's End.
I've heard of it. She still held the lock casket, not yet ready to lift the lid on what was inside. Morgravia let her eyes close for a few seconds.
Throne. This needs to be ended.
She eased open the lid, looked down.
Perhaps they have given up the hunt, suggested Hel after a few moments.
No, that's not it. They're waiting.
For what?
For me to remember, said Morgravia, and took an item from the lock casket. It was a sigil, an adamantium metal strip fashioned into the shape of a capital letter I, with three bars intersecting its horizontal axis. A synthetic wax seal in the shape of a jawless skull affixed to the midsection. Morgravia regarded the sigil in her hand. We were here for a reason, Hel.
I just wish I could remember what that reason was, she said, and put the inquisitorial rosette away.
Throwing on her long coat, she made for the door. Are you coming? She said. But Hel had already gone.
Quietly, she said reflectively. Good girl.
The city stank of rot and venality. Tall Gothic structures pressed in either side of a main street, leaning over the shuffling crowds like bent-backed old men. Huge statues sprouted liberally amongst the urban decay, pushing aside buildings and soaring so high into the false atmosphere their heads were wreathed in mist, like the summits of mountains. Rivulets of moisture clung to their sculpted stone bodies, enhancing their godly aura, hands raised to the heavens, as if holding up the very roof of the world. A thin river of effluence wended through the heart of it, peeling off into little tributaries, a manufactured delta of filth and industrial waste. Morgravia drank it all in as she moved through the habitation district of Low Sink. She stuck to the bigger crowds, hood up and head down, her gaze flicking up every now and then to the overhangs, the gantries and the walkways. Hel would be up there somewhere, staying out of sight, flitting from perch to perch with an acrobat's easy grace. She trusted the death cultist, acknowledging she had little choice in the matter. Hel had dragged her from the sump overflow on the night Ashanti had died with his guts hanging out. She'd found the hab unit, tended her wounds, and wiped away every trace Morgravia had left behind. Without Hel, she would probably be dead. But Hel didn't know anything, save she had a duty to the Inquisition, and therefore Morgravia, with it. She possessed no knowledge of the mission or what the threat might be. She was a weapon, nothing more, and a slightly broken one at that. A light rain pattered on Morgravia's long coat, drizzling through the mouths of gargoyles crouched on the edges of slabstone tenements and spired factorum cathedra. Daisy chains of sodium lamps hung along the main civilian route, flickering and spluttering, casting long, knife-sharp shadows. Morgravia shuddered as the memory of the tunnel intruded on the present. She increased her pace, bulling her way past grimy dockhands, factorum serfs, and grey-faced servitor units. Several streets converged into a public concourse where a preacher babbled from a makeshift pulpit, spitting zeal and fury as he brandished a tatty book in the direction of his onlookers. It attracted a decent crowd, though the roads out of Low Sink were so rammed he could hardly have not. Even the proctors, shock mauls swinging lazily from their belts, clad in a black carapace and glaring through rain-spattered helmet visors, struggled to make way. One bellowed through a loud hailer, reminding every citizen of their throne-expected duty to report any mutant, heretic, or witch to the imperial authorities. Vigilance, he said, protects. Morgravia sincerely doubted that, and besides, she would have to flout that directive if she had any aspirations of convincing the broker, and she needed to convince the broker. Pushing through the throng, edging around a burly ogryn hauling a stack of crates wrapped in a tarpaulin on its back, Morgravia made for a side street. She had taken a few steps beyond the alley threshold when the pain hit like a Magtrans locomotive, poleaxing her to the ground. Flesh stretched, taut, tearing, ripping every seam, pulled apart to reveal red hot and red hearts beating, organs steaming, blades pushing through skin, twisting bones, splintering, skull cracking, spine bent double and bleeding. Red, 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 pain and pain and agony, a cut, a slash, peeling back every layer.
no crevice left untouched, bruised and battered, knives, two red suns looming, shearing, pinned back, and exposed a crimson flower in bloom, its petals spread to every cardinal destination, flensing, grinding, excise and exsanguinate until only red remains. And red is all there is.
She came to, a cry half stifled in her throat, hot tears stinging her cheeks, to see a shadow looming over her. For a second, Morgravia panicked, taken back to a past trauma she couldn't remember, a memory of knives and blood. Then she realised where she was. His hands were inside her long coat, rummaging. Morgravia jabbed the stub pistol into the thief's side, snarled, "I squeeze, and the bullet perforates your liver. It will hurt. You will bleed to death in this alleyway, and no one will mourn you." The thief backed away empty-handed, mumbling fearfully. Little older than a boy, he had a faint wash of downy stubble and bright, scared eyes. Dressed in rough clothes, he looked like a dock runner and capered off as soon as he hit the crowds, leaving the whiff of ammonia in his wake. Morgravia got up and dusted herself off. Someone had shoved a burning poker in her skull. That's how it felt. How it always felt. The red dream. She vomited in her mouth, tasting the acerbity of stomach acid as it seared her throat. She spat it up, wishing she had something to drink. She could imbibe later when she reached Hallow's End. Sweeping her gaze across the ledges and gantries above, she scowled.
"I see you pick and choose when you watch my damn back."
Hell, if she was watching, didn't make her presence known. Morgravia was about to walk on when she heard a commotion from the street outside the alley. She heard shouting. Some of the proctors were bellowing orders for people to stand aside. Someone screamed. Even the preacher's sermon had been interrupted. Wanting no part of it, Morgravia headed for Hallow's End, where the broker would be waiting. The Jew fell like a sack of dead meat. The gangers had enough sense to post lookouts at the perimeter of their territory, but Christo moved swiftly for a big man and had a keen eye for trouble. He was also supremely motivated. He didn't kill them. He loathed killing and felt the weight of those who had died at his hands like an ever-thickening noose around his neck. He hurt them, though. Broke bones, rendered them unconscious. Male, female, it didn't matter. All that mattered was the chain-wielding banshee in the fighting pit. The cordon of flickering drum fires drew closer with every step. As Christo moved deeper into the gully, he realised he knew this place, more by reputation than familiarity. It was Red Hand territory, at the least the very edge of it. The Jews he had put down wore patches depicting a crowned skull, mark of the Death Kings. Such ridiculous names they gave themselves. But the Death Kings were a rival faction to the Red Hand, which only meant more trouble and the possibility of a ticking chrono. Christo upped the pace to the rattling tune of a chain raking at a drum shield as the fight in the pit intensified. The mob bayed with every lash, urging violence, thirsty for more. Then a horn sounded, like a distant war cry, discordant, blaring. Christo turned, they all did, towards a ridge of refuse and debris that rose up like a grubby cliff. Lights flared, eye-achingly bright spots of magnesium white, and the rumble of engines suddenly eclipsed the catcalls like thunder rolling across a dirt sea.
"Shit!"
The ticking chrono was ringing. The interlopers had bloody handprints daubed on their faces and rode down the ridge on grit bikes, jinking left and right, kicking up dirt, dust pluming from their tyres. Blades and axes whirled menacingly as they arrowed in on the other gang. An ash runner, a much larger bike, grunted behind them. Petrochem spewed from its twin chrome exhausts. The rider was leant back in the saddle, his plate armour and the chain blade strapped to the bike's hefty frame marked him out as the gang leader. Gunshots rang out, The riders had sidearms as well as blades. The Death Kings gathered around the fighting pit, scattered. A few pistols barked back. Someone in the crowd got hit and went down. The girl in the pit with the improvised shield took her chance, and Christo cried out, despite himself, when she smashed her chain-wielding opponent in the neck. Heads turned, shocked at the burly bullet maker in their midst, but they were too busy with the riders to really worry about him. Christo barreled on, hoisting a ganger that got in his way up and over his shoulder. He barged another from his path, swatting the ganger aside, not missing a step as he rushed into the pit to the side of the fallen.
Corinna!
She lay curled in fetal agony, choking for breath and clutching at her throat. A rider sped past a few feet away, whooping and crowing. He hit something, a hatchet blade slapping into skin. Blood arced. It spattered Christo's cheek, hot and sudden, and he looked up to see one of the Death King's Juves fall with her head caved in. The girl on the ground next to him could barely breathe. Her eyes rolled as a bruise blossomed menacingly across her larynx. She'd taken some licks in the pit too, deep cuts that bled beneath a leather jerkin. Christo's palms came away wet and red, and he stared at them, horrified, for just a second. Then he swept his massive arms under and around the girl, scooping her up. She gripped his arm, pinching the skin with what little strength she had, her eyes bright with fury.
You can shout at me later, he said.
And that was that. They were moving, Christo ploughing back up the ridge towards the overhang, while Corinna clutched his bulletmaker's garb. She need not have worried about him dropping her. Christo kept a tight grip, and nothing but death itself would see him relinquish it. He only slowed down when a rider came circling around, whooping and hollering, his grit bike carving an arc in the dirt. A long spiked chain shrieked around his head, the brutal torturer with his lash. It whipped out towards Christo, who ducked its bite and kept moving. Swiftly losing interest, the rider peeled off and went in search of better prey in the gully. Skirmishes had broken out across the entire expanse below the overhang as fighters poured in from either faction. Christo had to run through them, though chose to largely skirt their ranks. In the snatched glances he got, he reckoned the Red Hands had the better of it. Their riders cut back and forth, scything through the Death Kings like horse-mounted savages, but reinforcements for the beleaguered gangers were still coming. Crackling gunfire rippled across the gully in staccato outbursts of muzzle flare as gangers ran between snatches of cover, or else fell, clutching wounds, or simply fell and did not rise again. Christo felt a sharp pain in his arm and looked down. Corinna had dug in her nails, drawing blood.
Down, she rasped. We need to keep moving.
They were out of the worst of the fighting now, just a few fleeing Juves flanking them at a distance. But they wouldn't be safe until they reached the overhang, so Christo ignored the pain and carried on. She stabbed harder, and he had to clench his jaw to keep from crying out.
Down.
He put Corinna down. She immediately snatched a knife dropped by a dead Juve, whose eyes were fixed upwards to a sky he would never see, a bullet hole gaping in his forehead. Corinna barely noticed him. She immediately headed eastward across the gully, cutting back in a diagonal line from the fighting. But Christo put a hand on her shoulder to stop her. She whirled on him, her expression furious. More gunfire snapped from below, pushing them into the shelter of a broken piece of the old bridge. Shots pranged off the granite chunks before being directed elsewhere. Christo shook his head.
Not that way.
East is Death King's territory. Red Hand won't risk approaching the border.
Like you didn't with their territory.
She frowned at that.
Where then?
Christo pointed to the arc of the sundered bridge and the shadows beneath it.
The overhang.
And then what? Back to Mega? I don't think so.
Corinna continued in her original direction, but Christo stopped her again. She snarled, lashing out with the knife, but Christo caught her wrist.
I can make you, Corinna,
he said, his voice harder than he meant it to be, before it softened again.
But I don't want to.
He saw in her eyes that she knew he could do it.
You won't take me back,
she swore.
I belong here.
She looked to her gang, but the fierceness in her expression slowly turned to despair as she saw the red hands literally taking the Death Kings apart.
Here is about to become nowhere, said Christo.
She turned on him, savage and snarling.
Then I'll be nowhere.
Christo held her gaze, knowing she had to climb down from her anger on her own, and anything he said now would inevitably be taken in exactly the opposite way it was intended. Seething, still fighting for breaths, Corinna relented.
I was winning,
she said, stifling a sob.
You were fearsome,
said Christo, and meant it, though it went against every instinct to say so. There was a short moment of silence between them, filled by the sounds of gangers fighting and dying, before Corinna relented, and they made for the overhang.
Why did you come for me?
She said, after a few paces.
I don't know how you can ask that.
Christo risked a look back, making sure they weren't being followed. He had been about to elaborate further when he thought he saw something in the skirmish below that made him slow down, and then stop.
Don't tell me you've changed your mind,
said Corinna, stopping too. She was a little way ahead. Even injured, she was faster on her feet than him, and looked back down the ridge. Christo didn't answer. The overhang was close, but he was drawn to the battle as if his mind couldn't reconcile what he was seeing and therefore refused to let him look away.
Something happening,
he began, but couldn't finish. Corinna snapped, irritatedly.
What is it?
The skirmishes had coalesced, devolving into a massive brawl. Either the gangers had run out of ammunition, or they simply wanted to hack at each other hand to hand. But this wasn't just bloodlust or territorial anger. Several gangers, badly wounded by the look of them, were fighting frenziedly. They had abandoned their knives, cudgels and other weapons, and went at their foes with bare hands, nails and teeth. There was screaming, not the kind of screaming to fire up the blood, or even the mortal scream of death or severe pain. It was terror, pure and abject. Some of the gangers were trying to break loose, but got snarled up. Christo couldn't quite make out why. He did see the leader of the Red Hand. His ash runner had got snagged, too. Something had tangled around the wheels. They looked like limbs. Stood up in the saddle. He hacked around himself with the chain blade. Gore and matter flew wildly. Then he was dragged by dozens of grasping hands, and the last stand ended. Christo's eyes narrowed.
Bloody throne.
He quickly turned, suddenly aware of Corinna behind him. He didn't want her to see this.
It's nothing, he said.
Damn it, father,
she shouted. Christo got in her way, making sure she wouldn't see.
It's nothing,
he said again.
Please,
he added, and in the use of his simple plea, he saw understanding, if not full comprehension, in her eyes. She relented, but asked in a quiet, almost fearful voice,
What is it?
Nothing we need be a part of,
he said, and gently turned away. No father would want his daughter to see this, assuming he could even say for certain what he had actually seen. They pushed on, Corinna flashing nervous glances in her father's direction, Christo doing his best not to look shaken. His head hurt all of a sudden, like he'd been squinting under the labour's pit lumens for too long. A dull ache that pressed in at his temples like insistent, probing fingers. It couldn't erase the image from his mind, though, as he and Corinna reached the shadow of the overhang, of what he had seen in the gully. They were eating each other. Chapter 3. fog. Morgravia took a maglev to the other side of Low Sink. The magtrans was about the only thing in Low Hive that still functioned with moderate dependability. It served as a public shuttle for the labourers, scriveners and other menials required for the hive to function. And Blackgeist's overmen, the nobles, oligarchs and plutocrats that ran the city, had a financial interest in its continued reliability. The world's industrial output, the raw materials extracted and mined from her bedrock, had made the overmen rich and powerful. Ostensibly, they served the Imperium, meeting their tithes and observing their duties in the furtherance of the great war machine. Actually, they served themselves, their ivory towers built on the blood and bones of less privileged men, shielding them from the worst of the lower city's depravities. The Magtrans kept those towers lofty, shipping goods as well as labour, and ferrying it to the high docks where it was packaged, sealed, and assigned for usage off-world. The train ran the edge of the natural basin into which the settlement of Low Sink had agglomerated over time, the name having sprung from its concave geography. Magnetic repulsion kept the heavy metal carriages a few inches above the rail, though the commute was far from smooth. A rattling coffin box with slits for windows and standing room only was a less than inviting environment in which to take a long journey. Morgravia shared air, space and body odour with a sweaty press of dirty factorum workers, dockhands and other sundry folk. Few spoke, their minds on whatever toil lay ahead, though the quiet shaking of the carriage was broken up by religious sermons piped through vox emitters.
Maintain your vigilance. Fear the witch. Mutation is heresy. Corruption lies in apathy.
She knew the words by rote. She had spoken them enough times, though recalling any specific instance was currently beyond her reach. That's why she needed the broker. Instincts remained: how to fight, how to move covertly, how to interrogate. But actual solid memories did not. She knew the extent of her influence, the power it granted her, but she dared not risk employing it, not when the face of the enemy was still hidden. They had tried to kill her, whoever her quarry was. This she knew with instinctive certainty too. For now, they either thought she was dead or had stopped looking for her. That anonymity had to remain intact. It meant receiving no help beyond what she already had, and no transport that would attract attention. Ships, even junkers, were out. And so she favoured the maglev. Public, nondescript. No self-respecting inquisitor would deign to traverse in that cattle barge. It served her well as a perfect disguise and a place to marshal her thoughts. Morgravia supposed that Hallow's End had been chosen as a venue for the meeting with the broker on account of its relative obscurity. Situated at the very western fringe of the basin, just inside the border of a settlement called Meager, it had one foot in the Badlands, the territory of the gangs. This did not concern her. The Red Dream, on the other hand, it had manifested after her liberation from her captors, and the natural assumption was one had caused the other. The dream must be tied to her fragmented memories, but the kaleidoscope of images and the sensations that accompanied them defied rationalisation. To piece herself back together, she needed a witch. A sudden jerk arrested those thoughts as the maglev slowed to a stop. The carriage lowered itself down onto the guide rail beneath it as its repulsion engines cycled down. With a hiss of released hydraulic pressure, the doors lumbered open on screeching casters to let in the reek of Meager. In the distance, a bell tolled. The last of the passengers pulled on rebreather masks or tied scarves as they left the carriage. Mulgravia shuffled along with them, attaching her own mask as she ventured out. Hazy fog lingered low to the ground, clinging in a creeping veil. Jaundiced with toxins, where it met structures, it lapped at their sides like an ethereal sea. Its tendrils gently tugged around Mulgravia's ankles and reduced the departing passengers to muddied silhouettes. It obscured much of the cityscape, but even with this generous softening of detail, the impoverished nature of the place was all too apparent. The faces of beggars loomed out of the morass like unquiet spirits desperate for exorcism. Sickly children huddled together for warmth, taking shelter in the shells of dilapidated buildings. Feral dogs scurried through ruins, barking mournfully, only kept at bay by grim-faced proctors who travelled in packs. Mulgravia took side streets, following signs of flickering neon, until she came upon a pugnacious blockhouse, barely visible through the fog. It squatted between larger industrial structures, its stout frontage flanked by ferrocrete buttresses and jutting like a pugilist's chin. A shed stood appended to one side, slabbed by plate and bolted tight. Armoured shutters sheathed the windows, yielding to a single dingy aperture that served as the entrance of the establishment. A light flickered in the mouth of the doorway. Not exactly an invitation, but neither was it unwelcoming. The faint strains of music echoed from within. Mulgravia followed them. Hallow's End beckoned. It was as warm and dark as a womb inside. Old sodium lanterns threw off a weak, bluish glow that described a large room flanked around three sides with private booths. A communal area lay in the middle, a roughly carpeted expanse that led to a raised bar protected by a cage of wire mesh, with drinks served through narrow gaps like arrow slits. To one side of the bar, a small stage played host to a female singer in a long, dark dress that went beyond incongruous all the way to appropriate in the eclectic setting. She sang of sorrow, of dead men heading off to war, and the loved ones they left behind. A wizened theremin player provided accompaniment, plying the invisible strings of his instrument in a beautiful lament. His green velveteen suit matched the gemstones on his ringed fingers. The musicians appeared indifferent to the seedy surroundings, lost in the reverie of their song, and Mulgravia found she envied them. She delved deeper and plunged into a cloud of obscure smoke. It floated in purple ribbons, giving off the scent of spice and lavender, and coiled around the patrons like an eager lover. The colourful pall emanated from a fat man supping on a hookah pipe, chortling at his own indolence as he pawed at a bevy of languid, dull-eyed courtesans attending him. His considerable bulk nearly filled a private booth, and he sweated in the heat under saffron-hued silks and gilded finery. A merchant, trade rich and morality poor. His shadow was in considerably better physical shape and exotically armed. He wore a flechette pistol tucked in a visible shoulder holster.